is an idea that still has strong support and resonance, not only in this country, but around the world. And that the units of the national park system and the park system as a body is still respected and still visited. As we indicated, Paul indicated, we're setting records this year in terms of visitation. So there's still a lot of the American public out there that appreciate us. I think what is also working is the investment that we've made, particularly over the last 10 years, to have a much deeper, more scientifically based, more quantitative understanding of our natural and cultural resources. And we are moving, I think, more closely to a science-based organization that is really built upon long-term data sets. I think that what is also working is our relationship with our partners, our volunteers, our friends groups, our foundations. I certainly realize that the Park Service cannot, in of its own, the federal employees, operate these places without the great support of our many partners. And we are working very hard to make that relationship work even better. The employees of the organization, the some 25,000 employees that we have in the field, are in many ways our greatest strength. We have an extraordinary group of well-educated and deeply dedicated employees that are doing a great service to the public, to the American people. And last but not least, in the positive side, there's a great deal of innovation that is going on in the National Park Service. It is work reconnecting kids to the outdoors, to restoration of damaged environments like the Everglades and the Redwoods and Jacquemini Wetlands and Port Reyes, to the use of technology and social media. There's a lot of innovation going on that is bubbling up from the bottom to bring national parks to everyone. Now, not everything is perfect out there. There are problems. And yesterday I spent a lot of time talking about climate change. I believe climate change is the greatest threat we have to the national park system, to the physical resources, the biological resources, the cultural resources that we have. Climate change is a very significant concern for us. And the lack of connectivity on the landscape scale between parks and other areas where would allow for the movement of wildlife. Relevancy, as I look out in this audience, as I look out on every audience that is related to the environmental community and the parks, it tends to be a lack of diversity. And that is a problem for all of us that are concerned about national parks. And last but not least, but sometimes I think the budget is overrated, but we have a perpetuity mission on an annual appropriation. And that really is not sustainable over the very, very long term. And so I think budget will always be a concern for the National Park Service as long as we are completely tied to an annual appropriation.
Great.
I'll stop there.
Thanks, John. Teresa.
Okay, well, thank you for having me here today, and on behalf of the National Parks Association, it really is a pleasure to be in Montana. We couldn't be in a better place to talk about our national parks and the beauty of certainly Glacier and the crown of the continent. And I want to thank all of you for the work that you do, because without reporting and speaking out on the issues and certainly the challenges and opportunities, we would not be successful. So it's critical that you continue to write the important stories and make sure that the public hears what is happening. I think what we have seen as far as challenges, and I'll start the opposite, and John's not surprised.
No, not at all.
Let me talk about some of the challenges just in this last couple years with the significant economic decline. And thankfully, the national parks had Ken Burns and Dayton Duncan telling our story, telling the story of the national parks that belong to all of us, and really reconnecting the American public. Because what that did was that really made people realize, those that didn't know the story and the value, to reconnect and want to go to these places. And even during these tough economic times, we saw a visitation increase by almost 4%, so which was pretty significant. And I think that tells you how important national parks are to the American people and to the world. But there are challenges, and many of the challenges the national parks face, they've faced for 40 years, 60 years. They're not new challenges. And certainly in 1919, when the National Parks Conservation Association was founded, there was a recognition that national parks would always be threatened and always face adversaries. And so we needed an organization that could help to protect and preserve and speak out for the national parks. And so in areas of funding, we've been very vocal and very concerned because the federal funding has continued to be pretty bleak. While we've had some high points in the last couple budgets where we've seen increases in the operation budgets, we've made progress certainly with the stimulus and have been able to deal with some of the backlog, the $9 billion backlog that exists in our national parks. We are still far short of meeting the operations goal and the needs of the national parks. And that impacts all of your visitor experience, and it certainly threatens the future of the national parks. So it's a critical issue. It's an issue that we need to keep talking about, and we need to find solutions and dedicated funding sources. The threat of development is a real issue. And just within the national parks themselves, many people don't realize, but there are many inholdings. In fact, 1.8 million acres of land that is privately owned. And the National Park Service does not have the funds to be able to purchase through willing sellers that land and be able to really, truly protect the national parks for all of us for the future. And so that's a huge issue, and we've been advocating for Land and Water Conservation Fund, full funding, which could help provide the resources to be able to deal with that. And then there's the climate change, which John mentioned, a huge issue. And we already are seeing the impacts with the glaciers disappearing in Glacier National Park. We're seeing it with Joshua trees disappearing in Joshua Tree National Park, and certainly the impact it has on wildlife and the migration. Parks are not islands, so if we don't protect the larger landscapes, if we don't provide that connectivity, it's going to be a huge problem. Air pollution. One in three national parks are not meeting EPA's air quality standards for a healthy park. Huge problem. Do people want to go to Smoky Mountain National Park and have an asthma attack or problems breathing, which certainly has happened in Sequoia and many other parks? If we want to see these places remain the healthy and vibrant places that people go to really rejuvenate, we have to make sure that we address that issue. And the relevance issue that John mentioned is huge. We have to provide a connection and the relevance to a diverse audience to our national parks. So lots of challenges, and our opportunity really is through America's Great Outdoors with this president. We have a trifecta in John Jarvis, in Secretary Salazar, and President Obama. If we can't make something happen now, I'm not sure when we can. So America's Great Outdoors, national parks have to be a major feature in that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Holly.
Well, I'd like to thank you for inviting me here today. As the one local that's sitting here, I think I've also invited not only as a local, but to take a slightly different perspective. I think at the end of the day, our goals for the panelists here, which is a great, very diversified panel, are going to be very similar. That is, we want to see our national parks. We want to keep them protected. We want to keep them for our own enjoyment today and for the enjoyment of generations to come. But I think our methods of getting there are probably going to differ a little bit. With that in mind, I'd like to clarify a few ideas about economists. We're oftentimes accused as being rather brazen people because as economists, we really try to point out what is and what is really happening in the world today rather than what we think should be happening in the world today. We try to look at how people behave and the incentives that are provided, why they behave the way that they're behaving, and if we wanted to change the outcome, what we might do to change those incentives to get individuals to behave in a different way. Because when it comes down to it, economics is all about choices. It's not about finance. It's not about stock markets. It's not about bonds. It's about choices and human behavior. And I think many people don't understand that. We have to make choices because we have limited resources. And our national parks are part of those limited resources that we have. But our resources, whether we're talking about our landscapes, whether we're talking about our finances, whether we're talking about our time, they're limited. So we have to make choices. And a choice to do one thing with our resources is also a choice to not do something else. So when we're talking about the resources that we're using and where we're putting those resources, I want you to really think about where those resources are going and where else they could be going so that we make sure that we're using our resources in a wise manner. I'd like to say, for starters, that even this holds true for our federal government. There is no pot of gold at the end of the government rainbow, okay? I know many government actors believe there is. Nonetheless, when we reach in that pot to spend money, that means that's money that's not available for other resources. So we need to think wisely about how we're spending those resources. To come to the parks and what's working in our parks, I think that the national parks are beautiful. I couldn't agree more with the fact that the idea of parks are working. I live in Bozeman, Montana, just 200 miles southeast of here. I live 90 miles from Yellowstone Park, which we frequent quite often. And I have numerous visitors that come stay with me summer after summer after summer to come visit our parks. And they visit our parks, and you can just see their whole demeanor change. They become very relaxed. They see a whole new world. They see a whole new perspective on the world. And that idea of our parks is absolutely fabulous. I think where our problems exist is from the political influence. I think I'm sort of repeating some of the ideas that are said here. Political influence, we look at our managers in our parks, and we have these managers and these employees that are very devoted. I've worked with many of them, or at least talked with many of them, discussed ideas with many of them. They're very devoted. They're very interested in trying to protect our landscapes. They have pretty good ideas as what the priorities are in their units and what should be done in those units to make sure that we're protecting these areas for our future generations as well as for us to visit today. But they oftentimes feel very hand-tied. They can't do what they need to do. And again, it comes back to those ideas of budgets. And those budgets that are tied to Congress. Our budgets are appropriated by Congress. Most of that budget, or a big majority of that budget, is actually spent on our overhead, on our personnel services. There's very little money that's available to be spent for other projects in our parks. There is some project funding as well. But I would suggest that project funding is very politically driven, even though it's by park request. Politicians are determining what is actually going to be funded. And it is in the best interest of politicians to provide visible benefits today and to try to defer costs into the future. So if one was to try to predict what our maintenance backlog would look like, we would predict it would be very large, because it is not in the best interest of politicians to spend finances day-to-day for that day-to-day maintenance. They don't get that visible benefits. They don't get reelected by providing dollars for day-to-day projects. They get reelected for cutting ribbons. They get reelected for creating new parks. They get reelected for creating great visible benefits for their constituents. And as a result of that, resources are put into some of these new ideas rather than being used to maintain our day-to-day systems. So with that, I think it creates what I call crisis management when we finally get those day-to-day maintenance that falls so far behind, that is so dilapidated. We have sewage systems in Yellowstone National Park that were leaking about a decade ago. It took the tragedy of them actually leaking into Yellowstone and a lawsuit threat by Wyoming because of water quality to finally bring politicians to say, gosh, we're going to save the day here. And then it was a very visible solution, so politicians were able to respond. So with that, I will pass the ideas on.
Thank you, Holly. And Dayton.
Thanks very much. Thank you for inviting me here. For the last 10 years or so, I've been looking into the history of the national parks, and so my views are sort of informed by the look across those 150 years of this incredible American idea. And although in pursuit of that history, it took me to all the parks I've visited, all 58 of the natural national parks in pursuit of the project that Ken and I did. So while my pursuit was history, obviously I spent a lot of time in the present talking to people there. I think we're coming out, my view is over that 10 years, that we're coming out of a period of lowered public interest in parks, coming out of a period in which the park personnel went through, quite frankly, a demoralizing nearly decade of time where they felt that their values and their views were not being paid attention to. I would just say that, you know, that is politics. Politics in a democracy is how we make the choices of how we deal with our limited resources. So it can both be a pejorative, but it also can be the statement that that's how a democracy makes choices. We do it through politics, and there are other other cultures have tried other things, but democracy is the one that gets my my vote. Anyway, we've come out of that period of time, I think, of a lowered public interest in parks a little bit. Visitations were down. I think that the park personnel were somewhat demoralized, and echoing something that Teresa said, I think that this is a moment in history. My view of the history of the national parks and the national park idea is that the public is always in support of the parks. And occasionally, when we're lucky, we get national leadership that reaches down, and that energy from the top meets the energy from the bottom. And as those of you who know science, that's when lightning happens. The energy from the ground meets the energy from the top, and things happen. And that's, you can count on probably one hand the administrations that have pushed, you know, met that energy on the ground and moved the park idea forward. And I have hopes that this is going to be one of those moments in terms of the interest that the president has, certainly the ambitions that Secretary Salazar has. And I'll just put a plug in. I think that, you know, John's selection as the Park Service director was a signal to the demoralized staff that they had reason to hope that someone from their ranks, someone who is a biologist, who puts a premium on making management decisions based on science, was now going to, someone with a lot of experience with different parks and different levels was going to be their leader, was a great signal to the parks. The challenges going forward, so visitation is now up. There is this potential moment in history, I think, where things can happen with innovation and leadership. And the challenges really are about the same that they've always been, with the exception, of course, of global warming. In 20 years, the challenge for the Park Service is, what will you name Glacier National Park when there are no longer glaciers to see there? But those challenges of global warming are not just to the parks, they're to the whole planet. And the parks, to a certain extent, act as canaries in coal mines. There's always been problems with money. When they created Volcano National Park, they didn't put any money. This was in 1919, 60 years after the first national park was created. And they still, the initial impulse of Congress was not to appropriate any money for it. As one congressman said, it shouldn't cost any money to run a volcano. There are always threats. You know, there's always someone, part of who we are as Americans, someone's going to look at a raging river and say, what a great place to build a dam. Someone is going to look at a mountainside and wonder if there are valuable minerals under it. Someone's going to look at a virgin forest and think, how many board feet would that make? Or a beautiful view and say, what a great place for a series of trophy homes. That will always be with us. As John Muir said, the challenge, the fight for conservation is an endless fight. The challenge for us is whether we will create a new generation of park and conservation champions. And that is a challenge that faces us as Americans every generation, not just for conservation and parks, but for the what is the meaning of freedom and liberty is something that each generation has to come to grips with, reinterpret, and hopefully, if we're lucky, that generation will push the ball a little bit forward.
Great. There was a common theme in everybody's thoughts here, which was funding and money. And the country has debated this. Many people in this room have broadcast stories about it and written about it over the years. And I'm curious, from each of your perspectives, how we should pay down that maintenance backlog. Should we have higher entrance fees for people? Should we have corporate partnerships where you go to Coca-Cola Glacier National Park? Should we have privately run national parks, or should we raise a certain tax on backpacks? What do you think? Maybe I'll start with you, Director Jarvis. Where should the $9 billion come from?
Well, let me try to characterize the $9 billion. Over the last 6 or 7 years, the Park Service invested pretty extensively in really understanding the quantity and quality and condition of our sort of physical plant. So the number is actually a fairly decent number. It has a fair amount of solid data behind it. Now, the number is $9 billion, but actually for about half of that is roads, first of all. And then about $2.8 billion of that are what we call critical systems, the wastewater treatment plants, the water purification systems, those kinds of things that are really, really critical. So there is a hierarchy within that large number. We're spending, on average, about $250 million a year, setting aside the Recovery Act for a moment. But we're losing ground. We lose ground on all of this at a rate of about $650 million a year. So we're losing about we're putting about a third in, and we're losing two-thirds. So we're losing ground, no question about this. Part of it is looking at all forms of existing revenue for the National Park System. We do generate about $150 million in fees. That's mostly entrance and rec fees, recreation fees, and about another $100 million or so in concession franchise fees. One of the problems, so you got about a $250 million revenue stream coming into the National Park System on an annual basis from our fee program. Personally, I am not in favor of raising fees. I think we've sort of pushed it about as far as possible. The last administration was very strongly supportive of the fee program and pushed us to increase fees. I do not want fees to be a disincentive to the American public, particularly those who are in the lower end of the economic spectrum, to come to parks. Parks should be for everyone and should not be priced out one segment of the population. The problem, though, is that $250 million or so goes into the federal treasury. Now, we get it back, but we get no interest. And so if you think about that as a business, you would be investing that money and at least returning some interest on that account. And that would be one area that I hope to change over time, is that the National Park Service could receive at least the interest off that, because that money is collected and basically sits in a treasury account, and the interest goes into the treasury, not into the National Park Service as well. I do believe that philanthropy and partnerships, and in some cases with corporate partners, if carefully structured, we're not renaming anything in their honor, there can be partnerships with Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola right now is funding the recycling program on the National Mall. There are opportunities out there to help structure all of our sources of funding in a way that that can help. Ultimately, I believe the National Park System needs an endowment, needs to be building towards a very large. I mean, like I said, we're a perpetuity organization on an annual appropriation. Anybody else that's in the perpetuity business is thinking about an endowment, and that's ultimately where I believe we need to go.
Teresa, what do you think?
I think John covered certainly quite a bit. As I said before, I think there are choices. I mean, I think Holly articulated as well, we make choices in where we spend our dollars, and I think in some cases we've made some bad choices. So I would suggest that we need to look at the federal budget and make sure that national parks are getting the kind of funding that they need and that we all clearly articulate. So it is about choices. Certainly the Land and Water Conservation Fund is an important fund to fully fund, so I think that's another opportunity. Prior administration looked at something called the Centennial Challenge, which we supported, which was a philanthropic match with the public funds. So there are ways through different kinds of structures that we can develop something that will encourage the private sector to really contribute and to certainly leverage their dollars. There's also a need to look further at leasing opportunities, looking at historic structures. Some parks do more of this than others, but a way to be able to refurbish and to improve those historic structures and provide some housing on the park where they exist is a possibility as well, to start to deal with some of that, and even the kinds of leasing agreements that we have with concessionaires with the National Park Service, to look at those and be able to provide an incentive for them to reinvest in those grand hotels and places that they operate within the National Park Service. Also looking at bills like the transportation bill. I mean, that's going to be reauthorized again. There's an opportunity looking at how that's structured and ways to be able to have more of that. We talked about the half of the $9 billion is in roads. Well, we need to look at other sources of funding, and certainly transportation fund is a huge source of dollars that could be funneled more appropriately into national parks, as well as looking at partnerships with land owners outside of parks and being able to devise and work different kinds of easements and things like that that can protect important wildlife corridors and those areas outside parks that are so critical without expending a lot of resources through partnerships with private landowners. So I think there's certainly a whole host of opportunities, and we need to look at all of them. But the federal government ultimately has to take responsibility for funding parks adequately.
Holly, how do we pay down the $9 billion? What do you think?
Well, I think we have lots of different ideas that are coming out here, and clearly depending upon the status quo and the way we've been funded in the past is not getting us anywhere. We see these little blips in maintenance, and in the stimulus package is likely to provide us with some of these additional revenues or additional funds to increase some of that maintenance coverage, but we're not going to see that forever into the future. So I do think we need to make some changes and make some reform. I disagree on the idea of fees, in particular with our destination parks. We have parks like Yellowstone and Glacier. We're not going to get just the general population coming to visit these parks unless they can afford to get here. It's not inexpensive to get here to Bozeman, Montana, and many of our destination parks face those same realities. Entering into Yellowstone National Park, you can get a $25, a seven-day pass, or a $50 annual pass where you can enter as many times as you want for the full year. If we wanted to pay down the operations expenses at Yellowstone, it would be $11 a day per person, given current visitation. I don't think that's pricing people out of the park. $7 per day in Glacier National Park. Now, this doesn't hold true for all of our parks. There are certain parks that don't get the same type of visitation, so we might try to look at some different types of situations. So what I'm trying to get at here is it's really important, I think, to get down to the local level and look at the local parks and look at those situations that those parks are in. Those managers at our individual parks are the ones that have the time and place information, that really understand what needs to be done in their parks, what visitors desire to be done in their parks, and that's putting that connection together. It's really important to link those fees with our visitors and them directly going to our managers. Sending them into that black hole of the general treasury is not a good option. Our Recreation Enhancement Act, prior to that it was called the Fee Demonstration Act, allowed those fees to go back to those units. Gaining
That's
interest
incorrect.
On that,
That's
I
incorrect.
Think, is a fabulous idea, something that I haven't thought about myself. I think that would be a wonderful thing. But nonetheless, I think it's really important that we connect that link between the visitors and between our park managers. So park managers have the information. What is it that we are desiring in our parks? What is that helps them decide what priorities we're going to spend on. I think that the land and conservation, Land and Water Conservation Fund scares me a little bit, LWCF, in the sense that most of those revenues that go into that are required to be spent on acquisition when it's on the federal side. And what that means to me is not so much buying up those inholdings, which certainly does provide some decreasing cost in our management, but it also means that we're going to see a lot more parks being created.
And we should just tell folks who might not know what the Land and Water Conservation Fund is. It was a fund set up in 1964. It's royalties that offshore oil drillers pay to the Treasury. And the original bill, or I think the legislation requires $900 million a year be spent on acquisition in places like BLM, Fish and Wildlife Service, National Parks,
Forest Service.
Yeah, Forest Service. And many administrations, Republican and Democrat, have not fully asked for the $900 and haven't fully funded it. They've actually used the money to make the deficit look smaller. So there's a multi-billion-dollar backlog that's owed on paper on that fund. I'm sorry,
right.
Go ahead.
And actually, part of that fund, half of that fund goes to state and local parks and issues and for funding for there. And there it can be used for management in other ways than acquisition. The federal side is acquisition. If we're taking care of those in-holdings, that's one thing. It helps us create better management, more efficient management. But again, when we look at politicians and what's in their best interest is to provide these visible benefits, and visible benefits, new parks are some of those visible benefits. As we start to increase our park acreage, we have limited resources. We're already struggling to take care of what we already have. Why on earth do we want to try to expand this park much greater? Park Service Director Ridenour, from a number of years ago, former director, called it the thinning of the blood. We continue to increase our acreage, then we also have to pay to manage those increases.
Dayton, where do we get the money for all this?
Well, I'm not an economist or a manager. It really comes down to these places, the idea of the national parks, this incredible idea that is only a nation like we, based on the founding document of the Declaration of Independence, could possibly have come up with. You know, unheard of at the time that it was, first expressed tentatively at Yosemite in 1864, which was that a large tract of land, beautiful, exquisite valley and ancient groves of sequoias, should be stopped from being privately developed and set aside, not for royalty or the rich or the well-connected, as in all of human history such places had been, but it ought to be not only protected and set aside from private development, but be accessible to everyone and for all time. It's just an incredibly powerful idea, as powerful as the statement in the Declaration of Independence. What that means in practicality is that it doesn't matter how long you've been an American. It doesn't matter how rich your daddy or your mom were, whether you have a trust fund. You are a co-owner of the most magnificent places on this continent, and the most important historic sites, the most sacred sites, that you are an owner of them. And as Americans, it is a commonly owned place. We all have one share in each of those places. And how do we deal with those things as a culture and as a government? Is that that's what government is for. That's what they're supposed to do. And times go, there are ebbs and flows of times. I think that the basic idea has proven itself very valuable. And there have been times, including during a time of an economic crisis that makes the one we've just been going through, look like a walk in the park. In the 1930s, the federal government decided to invest a lot in the national parks. It was part of what would have been now called a stimulus plan. The CCC was deployed, providing jobs and dignity to hundreds of thousands of young men who built things in national parks that you can still walk those trails, you can still go into those buildings. That was money that was spent, that was government tax money, on a decision that was made by our political leadership. Did everybody agree with it? No, they didn't. Does everybody agree with any decision that's ever made? No, they don't. But that's how we work these things out. And what is important, I think, as we move forward, is that we keep that in mind, that we're all the co-owners. If we can make sure that everybody understands that they have an ownership, once you understand the ownership of it, then you understand the necessity, maybe to take care of this property that you own a little bit. And the way that you do that is through the electoral process. That's how we work things out here. And so I agree with everything that most folks have said here, that fees are somewhat, are part of that. I would agree with John that I think they're right at the edge of the envelope at this particular moment in time. Philanthropy is very important and has been part of the park story almost from the beginning. Partnerships are important. Trying to set some money aside in an endowment, fully funding the conservation fund is important. But really what it finally comes down to is political leadership that decides either because the public is clamoring for it or whether just what leadership is sometimes seeing things over a longer horizon than the public often perceives and pushing us forward on that. So the basic answer is trying to get Congress, who are making choices all the time of where do we spend the money that we have, how do we allocate it? Do we do it, you know, to the Department of Defense? Do we do it for commerce? Do we do it for this, for education and everything? That's, you know, that's the way it works. And what has to happen is the people who feel the ownership of these places need to make a little bit bigger noise to say, put more in this because they're important to us.
Right. I have one or two more questions, and then get your questions ready. As I say, we have these mics, so if folks have questions, line up, and we'll start taking them. John, you wanted to respond.
Yeah, just two things. One is that the issue of relevancy and the issue of budget are linked, that we have advocates in the U.S. Congress and in the administration for the National Park System in its budget, and in many cases, even when an administration may be proposing reducing the budget, they have advocates on the Hill on both sides of the aisle that love the National Park Service and will step up. And these individuals come to these positions through their own personal experiences, and some of them are the result of their experiences as a young person in a national park. If that begins to decline and that we are represented in Congress increasingly by people that have had no experience with the national parks, then I really think that our future is at jeopardy when the choices are being made, whether it's defense or homeland security or EPA or education or the national park system. And so, you know, we're a very small segment of the domestic budget. I mean, we're $3 billion. I mean, that's just a few hours in the conflict in Afghanistan. So it's a small allocation, but it's important. The second thing is I just want to correct something that Holly indicated was about the fee program, and maybe I was unclear in my statement about it going into the Treasury. The fee program comes back directly to the national parks and directly to the collecting units. 80% of the fee collecting in the parks go back to the units, and the superintendent gets to decide how that money is spent. That does not go into some black hole Treasury account. My point was we don't get any interest off of it.
I think it used to, but that changed, right?
It used to go into a black hole,
yeah.
But with the FLORIA Act, it comes back to the National Park Service. 20% of that money is pooled and is used by the non-fee-collecting parks. There are many parks out there that do not collect any fees because they don't have an entrance point or it's complicated or it's too small, and they're allowed to use the 20% of that fee. But 100% of the fee program comes directly back to the national park system.
Now, one thing you hear about a lot in summer is visitation. And how many headlines have we all seen or stories on television or radio that talk about parks, quote, being loved to death? I think I've written a few of them, and I've seen them in just about every publication. And, you know, Memorial Day weekend, July 4th weekend, there's always media images of long lines of cars, and it's something that you hear people griping about when they gripe about national parks, which is rare, but it's one thing that's a common source of complaint. And various theories have popped up on how to deal with that. In the state where I live, California, folks have talked for years about whether you should have a reservation to bring your car into Yosemite Valley. We hear the same things in places like Grand Canyon. I guess I wonder whether any of you have thoughts on what we do about those big crowds. Should we have reservations on big weekends? Or should we just let them pile up at the entrance?
I'll let the managers and the people that do that talk about some of those specifics. But the larger issue on this comes down to this. What you don't want to have, the question of too many people crowding into Yosemite Valley is a management problem. How do you handle that kind of traffic? And do you have a parking lot, you know, at outside the valley, and you bring buses in? How do you get the several millions to peek over the rim of the Grand Canyon? Do you bring them to a certain place and then have a monorail that might take them? Those are management problems that I think innovative Americans can come to grips with. If you have the opposite of that, which is not enough people are coming to the parks, that becomes an existential threat, as John was just saying. One of the great challenges is in a growing population, increasingly urbanized, increasingly diverse, increasingly unaware of this legacy that is theirs, these great opportunities that are await them at a national park, whether it's Yellowstone or Yosemite or Golden Gate or someplace that is close to there. The moment that is a thinning of the blood, you really don't want to have. That if it gets down to a smaller and smaller proportion of Americans feel a connection to these majestic, wonderful places that belong to them, then you're going to have real troubles. Because as we've all said, you know, that's if the champions of parks become a smaller and smaller minority, then it's, you know, pretty self-evident that the future of the parks becomes more and more in jeopardy. So I don't have the answer to exactly how, you know, I've indicated what I would think what might be a couple of good plans on some of the ones that are most crowded. Yeah. I will also say this, is that my experience in the parks, and to the extent that the Park Service has sometimes credited our film with how many more people came this year, I happily plead guilty. Because that's how you make park champions. If they come there, even if it's if you're a group of 4,000 people watching Old Faithful go off, it's still an impressive sight. And if you can convince some of those people that if you go 250 yards away from that parking area, you can have much more of the park to yourself than you ever thought. If you want to get up at dawn, as you guys did this morning, if we were in a national park, you would have had it. This would have been the total crowd dispersed around the park, because that's the most glorious time at a park, and it's also the least crowded.
Maybe I'll just go with Teresa real quick. Teresa, should there be reservations to get into the parks at busy times? What does your group think?
No. I don't think that's the way to go. I mean, I think that, as Nathan said, I mean, and there are parks that have come up with different shuttles. Cades Cove is an example, Sequoia, where you have the ability to take a shuttle and park maybe outside the park to reduce the traffic flow during busy times. Because most of the time, what we're talking about is a window. It's maybe 1 or 2 months, 3 months during the summer where it's really an issue in some parks, and certainly not uniformly. And in those parks, it's a management issue, and it's managing the flow of traffic. And certainly they've created some wonderful shuttles and experiences with interpreters that I think people can really enjoy and that drop people off at different designations to hike. So I would say that is a direction, as well as educating the public about the wonders of these places other times of year, and trying to encourage that to be spread out a little bit. I would say I'm not a big fan of, and I don't think NPCA is, of reservations.
Got it. Let's go John, Holly, and then we'll go to the questions from the audience. John.
Yeah, just, having worked in the national parks in large units, very, very popular Mount Rainier, had the responsibilities for Yosemite. I could take any one of you on the 4th of July in the Yosemite Valley and in 5 minutes have you completely by yourself. This concept that the parks are loved to death, I'd love to see us just get rid of that term. That's an old holdover of the 70s. As Dayton indicated, the public use of parks is a management, and it is a manageable impact to the parks. There are much greater threats that we need to be worried about in the national park system in terms of our long-term, you know, viability, in terms of external threats, in terms of climate change, than the public use of parks. The public, by coming to these places, it changes them. It creates advocacy and constituency. It creates long-term support. So I think visitation is a good thing. We just obviously need the money in order to manage that activity.
Holly.
I have to agree with what's being said here, but I guess my one concern is that if we do have so much congestion in parks, that we are turning people off and we are sending the wrong signal, and we don't want to send those signals. And I have heard of those signals. In fact, living near Yellowstone, we tend not to visit Yellowstone during the summer season because we want to go there when we can go on our own. And clearly, when we go on our own in the summer, we do leave the beaten path, and you can find beautiful areas that you can go. But I do want to sort of make point on fees. I think what would probably be expected of me to say here, though, is we can certainly use fees to try to reduce some of this congestion. That is one way of providing information to the visitors of parks to say this is a busy time, and if the fees go up during those busy times, then it helps people motivate to go during the shoulder seasons. In regards to the recreation and the fee program, I do understand. I'm sorry if I was if I stated it unclearly that fees do remain with our parks, and I think it's really important on those lines to think about those fees as visitors. We have this federal umbrella that's protecting our parks, but when we use our parks, we do damage as well. And quite personally, and as an economist, I think it's really important that we pay for that use rather than somebody else having to pay for that use through their taxes. So I think there's two components here that we really need to think about when we're thinking about funding our parks.
Great. Let's go to questions from the audience. Go ahead. You have one?
Do I have to say who I am?
Sure.
You don't have to.
Hi, I'm Chris Woodside, and I'm a freelance journalist and editor of Appalachia Journal. Mr. Jarvis, you said at the beginning of the day, of this morning, that you're moving more closely to a science-based organization that is filled with long-term data sets. And then later, you said that half of the $900 billion necessary to, I guess, boost the infrastructure of the park was going to go to roads, which, you know, makes you sort of think... So my question is, how do you move to a science-based organization? Are there other government organizations you will be cooperating with, or are you going to try to get more funding and have more scientists on your staff?
Good question. Everybody hear the question? How do we move more towards a science-based organization? A couple things have happened in the last, say, decade in the national park system. If I can just go back a bit, Dayton's work sort of explored the history of science in the national park system. George Melendez Wright, really the sort of first scientist in the national park system, and out of his own pocket developed a scientific program. Unfortunately, he was killed in a car accident, and the science program of the Park Service died with him at the time. Actually, the group of scientists that were there were picked up and carried over and created the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Over time, rebuilt our science program with scientists, research-grade scientists in the organization, and then Secretary Babbitt gathered all those up and sent them over to USGS, forming the Biological Survey. So we keep building a program and then losing it. So what has happened in the last 10 years is really the development of our what we call our Natural Resource Challenge. It was about an $80 million investment in the National Park System, sustained funding, that created a cadre of not research-grade scientists, but certainly PhDs, advanced degree individuals that were focused on what we call our Vital Signs Network, where we, in partnership with major science organizations like the National Science Foundation, universities, and the U.S. Geological Survey, we developed protocols to determine within each of the national parks that have predominantly natural resources, what are the critical parts of that park that need to be identified and monitored over the long term? What are the vital signs? Yes, think of it as the human body. You know, what is your blood content? What is your heart rate? You know, what is your lung capacity? We did that for the parks. And we now have fairly robust data sets for the 200-plus units of the national park system. We're on the cusp of really using that information in a more quantitative way to do scenario planning for climate change, to incorporate it into long-term planning for our general management plans, all those kinds of things. As an assistant to this, one is I've created a science advisor to the director, Dr. Gary Maclis from the University of Idaho, and we've created a science advisory group under the leadership of Rita Caldwell, the former director of the National Science Foundation. We'll have at least two Nobel laureates on that, and they will serve as an advisory group to me on really applying science to this. The backlog is a totally separate issue. That's an infrastructure issue. That's roads, buildings, trails, those kinds of things.
Yeah, I just brought that up because it sort of illustrates the challenge that you have just keeping things as they are,
right,
you know, money-wise.
Sure. Go ahead, Teresa.
I just wanted to mention we have a Center for State of the Parks that's done an analysis of 80 national park units looking at natural and cultural resource values. And we also work with consultants and scientists around the country and look at various specific issues. Certainly climate change has been one of them, and providing some additional resources and efforts to be able to advocate then for much of this science and this information and where there are challenges with the national parks.
And that's called, sorry,
the,
what?
The Center for State of the National Parks, State okay. of the Parks. So it's STOP. And if you go to our website, npca.org, you can pull that up and get that information.
Next question. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, my name's Roger Archibald. I'm a freelance from Boston, and I'm also a former seasonal ranger at several different parks. So I've seen it from both sides. My question is getting back to the backlog. Maybe this sounds simplistic, but what would be the possibility of creating a bond issue, say a conservation bond issue, similar to the way communities issue bonds when they want to rebuild bridges and roads, or even the government issued war bonds back during the war to help pay for important, you know, necessary expenditures like that.
Did everybody hear that question? What about doing some kind of a national bond issue to pay for the maintenance backlog? Thoughts?
Toss that to the economist.
off the cuff right off the bat, I think it sounds like a very reasonable idea to have a bond issue. I think, again, in my mind, one of the critical areas that we need to think about is how are we prioritizing where this money is going and who's doing that prioritizing? If it is done within the parks, again, we have managers that know what those priorities are. They know what needs to be done there. If it is done at the political level, it's just finding more money for politicians to determine what are their pet projects.
What
politicians
actually
have in their best interest to respond in the short run. They do not have a long-term outlook, and that's they have to because that's how they get it reelected. It's not because they're bad people. It's because that's what is required of a politician in order to be reelected.
What I had in mind was a bond issue to create the endowment that you're talking about.
As someone who was once a chief of staff for a governor, I think in general, I could be wrong, but in general, bond issues are more, I don't know of federal bond issues in the way that states and localities do it. Because states and localities do it because they can't print money. And the federal government, at least my understanding is, they generally don't go out and, you know, when they're building new buildings, they just appropriate the money or print the money. And if you're a state government or a local government, then you float a bond issue and you pay off the interest.
Let's get John's input, then we'll go to the next question. John.
We do have some folks that are looking into this. There is the potential in certain cases that we could issue bonds to because we do have a revenue stream, either from a concession operation or from a fee structure. So you need to have a revenue stream in order to really issue a bond. And but we don't have that authority right now, and that was something that Congress would have to grant us, that kind of authority.
Great. Next question. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Francesca Lyman. I'm a freelance journalist for a variety of magazines, among them Parks and Recreation magazine. And in the course of doing an article on carbon footprinting, I found out that the National Parks had done an extensive study looking at not just climate change and the science and how it's affecting the parks, but how to carbon footprint and figure out where those emissions are and how you can offset that carbon. And so I wondered whether the climate change issue, as well as being a tremendous challenge, could also be an opportunity to engage the public and create advocacy and constituency and all the wonderful things that you're talking about. Because in doing this, I found out that Zion had a plan to get people out of their cars and onto buses and all sorts of things. And also, in the course of doing the article, I came across parks advocates who said, why not have people doing restoration work, volunteers, building gardens and using the vast acreage for benefit for the public.
Let's take the first part of that, the climate part. John, what about the climate footprint of individual parks? Certainly parks have emissions. They put out, a lot of the visitors put out emissions. You've talked some about climate. What are parks doing themselves to reduce their CO2 emissions?
Well, there are really four pillars to our climate strategy, and one of those is mitigation. And in that regard, I believe, and I have a lot of support in the organization, that really the National Park Service should be an exemplar in terms of sustainability, that we need to clean up our own carbon footprint across the system, whether it's the use of biofuels, recycling, composting, the very best sustainable green building design work, fleet, hybrid vehicles, all across the board. And one step of that is the Climate Friendly Parks Program. NPCA has been an extraordinary partner in this process. We've set the goal to have all of our units of the National Park System complete the carbon footprint analysis by 2012, and then really develop an individual park-by-park plan to reduce their carbon footprint, setting very specific goals. We've already set the standard that all new construction would be minimum LEED silver. We've produced a couple of LEED platinum facilities already. The visitor center at Lassen, the visitor center at Eielson and Denali are LEED platinum facilities. The hybrid buses in Yosemite Valley. Joshua Tree is now producing 65% of its power input from solar. So we're all over this.
And you just put solar panels on the roof of Alcatraz. I wrote a story about that.
Yeah, exactly.
A couple months ago.
And the president will be putting solar panels on the White House, which, by the way, is a Park Service unit. The panels that were taken off when Jimmy Carter was there are still in storage. I think we're going to do with a new generation of them, though.
Now, our time is almost out, so we have time for two other quick questions. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, my name is Tom Morton. I'm a reporter for the Casper Star Tribune in Wyoming, and I was curious about how you deal with the inholdings that you talk about, because the Wyoming has state land inside of Grand Teton, and of course, you don't want to pay so much. The state wants to maximize whatever revenue it can get from that, and there are a whole bunch of really rich people who would love to build mansions there. So what's your thinking on how you deal with that?
Are you speaking specifically to the Teton issue?
Pretty much, because that's my state. But but in general, it would be kind of nice, too.
Well, in general, and Teresa indicated that there are millions, 1.8 million acres of private lands within units of the National Park System worth, somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 billion. Getting full funding in the Land and Water Conservation Fund is critical to that, to the acquisition of inholdings. We have a priority-setting process that goes through that to set a priority, essentially, and try to acquire these lands. In the case of the Teton lands, we've been working very closely with the governor and the Bureau of Land Management, and I think we are very close to a deal that will bring these prevent development of the Teton lands, which are right in the heart of Jackson Hole, looking right up fantastic, very developable lands, and bring them into the National Park System.
Last question. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Isabella Abrams, freelance writer and author of The Nature of Chicago, because I believe that city dwellers are so disconnected from nature. And I'm delighted to know that I'm a shareholder of these glorious places. But how are you involving families and persuading families and young people to enjoy the parks and to help sustain them? So it's a two-pronged question. How do you invite people and make them aware of the treasures that we have, and how are youth involved in preserving them?
It's a good question. This is a video game age. How do you get kids to put down the Game Boy and go see Glacier? Any thoughts?
Start with a really good series on public television. With a nice companion book for sale at the bookstore. I think that is a central challenge. And I think the encouraging thing is I think that the Park Service itself, NPCA, many other National Park Foundation, foundations, local groups, everybody understands that that is one of the central issues is how do you go about that? And they're trying many different, you know, trying very many different things of educational opportunities for kids from an inner city to go spend some time, you know, in one of the majestic national parks, or I'm on the board of the Student Conservation Association and trying to encourage kids to spend part of their time doing something either in a national park or a city park and creating a new generation of conservation leaders. There is no one bullet for this. It takes a lot of different organizations. It takes a lot of time. It takes money. And as my view of history of conservation and the parks is, it is always a struggle. The encouraging thing about history is that you look back and you see people who in the darkest of times stood up, said no to certain, you know, encroachments on parks or the conservation ideals of our nation, or somebody in the who worked years upon years upon years upon years to save a place, you know, for a future generation. It means that if you're out there struggling now and start to feel discouraged, history can tell you you're not alone, and history can also tell you for those who do struggle, as John Muir said, the trees and their lovers will sing your praises, and generations yet unborn will rise up and call you blessed. So it's a constant struggle, but history, I think, is a great balm to the people who feel discouraged about it. But it's also a great challenge that you just have to keep working at it.
Final thought from John, and then we're gonna break.
Yeah, just two parts of this. One is that urban parks are an absolute essential component to this. They create that threshold experience for families and for kids, their first case in many, many ways in the outdoors. And the second piece, and Paul did it, is put down that piece of electronic equipment and come see the parks. I disagree with that 100%. Our generation, mostly this crowd, is relatively old. Got to get over this thing about making them put away their electronics. They're going to use them. This is the new generation uses the electronics to experience the place. And so we have to embrace that. We've got to tap into that. We've got to, they want to create video. They want to do a rap song. They want to, you know, send pictures on Facebook. I mean, I was with kids the other day. And they said they were in the park. They were African-American kids from Washington, D.C., and they were taking pictures and posting them on Facebook as we spoke. And so get over it, guys. They're going to use their technology.
Fabulous. I want to thank all of our panelists. Please join me. Give them a good hand of applause. And just the housekeeping thing, as I mentioned, at 10:30 in the theater next door, Director Jarvis will have a press availability for about 25 minutes if anyone has more questions. I'd also encourage you to talk to the panelists privately because there are a lot of issues we didn't get to, and these are some of the top leaders in the country on this issue. So thank you very much.
Okay, our next session is going to begin here in about 10 minutes, and we'd like to thank Paul Rogers.